Hello, welcome to the photo show. Yes, it's a cold and frosty 6 a.m. here in the studio. It's very, very cold. And Wemo, the Belkin Wemo thing I've got for switching the radiator in and here from my bedroom before I get in the shower, so it's toasty when I get here, decided it wasn't going to work this morning, so I am freezing. Sorry we're not broadcasting live, but our work has intervened and the photo show has had to be done at a bit of a pace before I start work this morning. So with a bleary-eyed start, here we go. It's the news. Starting us off then, this is great, I love this. This is an application that's been written, it's an Instagram style thing, and it's written and aimed at rich kids, in inverted commas, for $1,000 per month, yes you heard me right, you can use this Photos app to post your pictures up on your feeds. You sign in through Facebook, and it's free, so you can get the app for absolutely nothing, but if you want to post anything, you've got to pay $1,000 a month. You can share your photos, but that's you've got to pay the fee, plain and simple. As I say, it's aimed at the little rich kids that are out there that that do this kind of thing regularly, and post about where they are and how much they're worth and that kind of thing, and pictures of themselves clothed in dollar bills. Why on earth you'd do that, I've no idea. There is a list, apparently, if you go to, you'd have to go to the Daily Mail, that's the only downside, but there is a list that's published of the wealthiest young people who are already using the apps, the app, and it includes a Ukrainian heiress and the son of a legendary fashion designer, in quotes. If you want to have a go with the app, then you can download it, but if you want to post anything, like I say, it's $1,000 a month. The good news is that one third of the membership fees that are gathered go to education of poor kids, in inverted commas. I don't know if that's a piss take, because that's what it says on their app, but it's patronising and shit, don't buy it. Do you remember seeing this photo? This was during Hurricane, that kind of hit the South Carolinas and Miami a few months ago. This is North Carolina, a place called Hope Mills, and it's a picture of houses that are almost effectively entirely underwater, right up to the first floor. This was posted by a chap on Twitter, I'm So First, at I'm So First, on Instagram rather. And a guy called Craig Williams was watching it, and he saw his brother's house in the photo. quite how you would know what street that was based on the fact you can't see any layout of anything on the ground, I'm not sure. But he got in touch immediately with I'm So First and said, please can you help? My brother's trapped with his old dog up on the first floor. So I'm So First got in touch with the rescue authorities. They managed to get there and get him off. And he filmed the whole thing as well. So there you go. Craig set up a GoFundMe page to raise funds for his brother to try and recover some of the lost property that he's had in the flooding. That is really bad. That's quite a shocking picture. Quite a shocking picture. A nuclear bunker has been converted to store film. We've got a link in the show notes here that's got a little 3-minute film on how it's used and stuff. The National Audiovisual Conservation Center is in Culpeper, Virginia. So it's right in the heart of US defense land, isn't it? And it was a nuclear bunker that was once used by the feds to hold billions of dollars worth of gold that they used to ship around the country and keep hiding. George Williman is the curator of the conservation center. And the center is storing nitrate film, which is the oldest and most dangerous type of film that can be used. There's 124 nitrate film vaults there, the largest nitrate film storage complex in the Western Hemisphere. And so nitrate is combustible, extremely combustible. Most of the films are the old celluloid stuff, but this one is apparently about as flashy as gunpowder. So it's extremely flammable. It's 90 miles of underground shelving. Many areas are kept temperatures below freezing so that you can't combust the stuff. And there's also a 206-seat theater where you can show film and digital cinema as well. And there are specialized areas for film repair, printing, processing, data transfer, and cylinder recording. The bunker is one of the largest and most unique archives of cinema film. I'm quoting there, found anywhere in the world. It is good. I'm sure they're doing a digital transfer process, but you'd want to have a backup of that kind of place, surely, now you've got it. But well done. I love this story, I have to say. This is an artist, Thomas Jackson, and he's embarked on a project that he's called Emergent Behaviour. He's taken all of the stuff that you see on the pictures that I'm showing you here. This is a picture of some plastic red cups that you'd use for a party. Here's a picture of some balloons floating up a pebbled beach. These are just basically hula hoops that he's got from a local toy store. But what he's trying to do is suspend these objects in midair to give the idea of the fact that they're like a swarming species, if you like, you know, milling around like a flock of birds or something like that. He's got a fascination with swarming species. It's his thing. And I've got to say, I really like this series of photos. I think they're really, really good. This one is some of those luminescent neck bands that you get at fun fairs and stuff like that. Each of the images is really impressive. This is my favourite of all. I love this picture here. It's almost like you're being shot at with something. It's absolutely brilliant. But what's kind of really impressive is that all of these images, none of them are done with Photoshop or any kind of special effects. He has gone out, there is a huge gantry built over where he's shooting the picture, and these items are suspended in air using fine filament. He hasn't even gone in afterwards and taken the filament away. So what you see is what was there on the day that it was shot. There is zero Photoshop on these. I'm sure he's adjusted it for levels and that kind of stuff, but that one, Tutu, is great as well. I really like it because I get a real sense of movement from it, and I think he's really captured the idea of these household objects swarming. The cups one is phenomenal. I love that. And each of those cups that you see there is suspended by a piece of filament from a gantry. How good's that? If you want to go and see it, it's at the Miller-Yazursky Gallery in Boston, and it starts in a couple of weeks' time on November 18th. Well done, Thomas. I thoroughly enjoyed watching those pictures, and I really, really enjoyed it. Really, really, really good. And finally in the news, CFA is to release a CF Express card. The thing with this card is it's going to hit 8 gigabits per second. That's the theoretical performance of it anyway. Compared to the top range of stuff, they're topping out at around 540 megabits a second. Here's a picture of a Lexmar one, 256, which is really, really impressive. The stuff I've got at the moment, I'm shooting video using, I think it's 130 megabits per second. And I've got to say, at 4K, it's capturing it just fine. I don't really see a problem with it. Whether the process is going to get changed or whether we're going to go up to 6K or something like that perhaps, and then these things will get on the kind of leapfrogging process of flash card memory to processor memory is still going on in the camera world, it would look like. But I don't think any of the equipment that we've currently got at the moment really tests the 540 megabits per second, unless you're talking about something that is at the red level maybe or something like that. But 8 gigabits would be fantastic. I mean, but it's going to take the technology an awful long time to catch that up. No price, obviously, though, but don't expect it to be cheap. The thing I love about cards going on and being much, much more expensive is the fact that all the cards that I buy and use just tumble in price. Thank you very much. I love it. Right, here we go. It's time for the gear. Starting us off, I don't know if Leica do this just to taunt me, but there is a shit off. I mean, sorry, there is an offering from Leica for the grip camera. So they've taken a Leica camera with interchangeable lens, and they've coated it in ping pong rubber. There you go. How cool's that? So yes, there is a Leica camera out there with interchangeable lenses which has ping pong rubber coated on the outside of it, so you can grip it. This has been created by an artist called Rolf Sachs, who's not as talented as Jonathan that I mentioned earlier, or Thomas that I mentioned earlier on. And I'd even go so far as he's not even as good as Miss Schneiderman that we mentioned the other week. Because I'm sorry, whilst it's beautifully made, that's just a gimmick. It doesn't look very nice. I'm sure that if you want to hit a tennis ball, table tennis ball with it, you'll get tons of spin off it. But it's a camera, and it looks ridiculous. They're only making 79 of these, though. So in terms of limited edition, it's extremely limited. Specs of the camera, I'm not even going to get into because, as you know, with Leica, I'm not a great fan. And I've had a couple of people write into me saying, have you ever owned a Leica? Why do you know about Leicas? I've used a Leica a couple of times, and I never liked it. I didn't think it was a particularly great camera. I didn't think any of the menus were intuitive. And I didn't think it took brilliant pictures in comparison to other stuff that takes equally good pictures. And it was ridiculously priced. But if you want to know ridiculously priced, then go buy this one, because this is $15,000. Yeah, you heard me right. $15,000 for a table tennis covered Leica camera. Wherever you buy this, just check your back after you've got out the store, because it's probably got a sign on it saying, kick me. Good God. Good God. Ricoh have released a 360-degree video camera. Now, there's been a few of these around for a while. Nokia do one, don't they, that's got like loads and loads of lenses everywhere. But this thing shoots genuine, supposedly, 360 video. There's going to be a big bulge on this, I would have suggested, based on the fact it's only doing it from two lenses. But it's the Ricoh Theta SC. If you remember the Theta S, that was the one before, then this is a stripped-down version of it, and it's stripped down because they want to save on the price a little bit, as well as you can control it from your smartphone with the app, so you can set it remotely and record you and your friends around a table or something like that. And I think, actually, if you look at that as a this is one of the promotional images. You got a group of friends sat around a table, all having a good time and chit-chatting with this thing smack in the middle, and there's a really nice record of that. I think this looks absolutely great. It does 5-minute recording to the card, that's it, tops. It doesn't do any longer than that. And it's an HDMI port for doing live streaming from 180 degrees if you really want it to. It's $300. I gotta say, I think $300 is excellent. Well done. Ricoh, top job. Would I buy one? Yeah, I might actually. I might. Ability to take 360 images and ability to take 360 video. Would I find a use for it? Yeah, I'd probably find a use for it somewhere out on site when people wanted a picture of the whole site that they could pan around or something like that. Whether it goes into a viewable app afterwards where you can use it to scroll around and it gets rid of some of the distortion on the lens, that would be kind of cool. If it does that, then yeah, I'm pretty much sold on it. But yeah, I was impressed with that story, I have to say. Sharpscaler has provided a new application which shows an awful lot more sharp upscaling. Now, I've got a couple of reservations here. Number one, it only comes in Windows, so you can't get it for your Mac. Well, that's bad luck, eh? But it happens. It's been developed by a guy called Stefan Gerlach, and quite how he's doing it, I don't know. So Photoshop, if you're familiar with Photoshop, uses bicubic interpolation to raise the images. It looks at the 9 pixels around a single pixel, or the 8 pixels around a single pixel, and from those 9 pixels, it then works out what is happening in that image and where it needs to go to expand it accurately. So it effectively takes that and multiplies it by 4 times, bicubic. I don't know how he's doing the upscaling. I'm guessing he's probably doing bicubic interpolation. The thing that's noticeable, though, in all of the images that he puts up as an example, is that the image is sharper. But just adding sharpening to something doesn't make it better, because sharpening is a tool in post-production. It's not a tool for it's not a tool for finishing an image generally. So I send images out to people and tell them that they're unsharpened. So if someone's making some boards for me, I say these are unsharpened images, and it's down to them to sharpen it based on their equipment. And likewise, if you're using an image and you're using it on the web, then you sharpen it really harshly because it's going to be shrunk down extremely small and it's going to be used in a very cluttered environment. Therefore, you want it to have some punch. if you're talking about making boards to go on walls, you would sharpen not at all or very little in order to get that to be done. So I don't know if this guy's got a better way of upscaling or whether he's just upscaling the images and then sharpening them. Either way, it's there. It's available on Windows if you want to go and get it and have a go. But I'm on Mac and I'm dubious. So, sorry. There you go. Display Purposes is a tool that will help you keyword and hashtag your images. I like this as a story. It's free. So you go to a website, displaypurposes.com, and basically you put in a tag of, you know, the obvious tag, if you like, for what your image is about. So say you've taken a picture of some architecture and it's a building. You could put in St. Paul's Cathedral as your hashtag. And it would then go and look on Instagram hashtags and find all the other hashtags that were associated with St. Paul's Cathedral. And it would show them to you so that you can pick more accurate and better hashtags. And I've got to say, one of the things that, this was the bane of my life years ago. Back when you used to do stock photography and you used to upload it to a website or you'd offer it up for a catalogue for print, you had to keyword the image yourself. And I always struggled with it. I'd put stuff down and I'd keyword the hell out of it and I'd have 20 keywords or something like that. And then someone would go, but you haven't put green because there's like a green hue across it. You're like, oh, for God's sake. And you forget something like that. So anything that helps you with keywording has got to be good. And the fact that this is looking at successful images on Instagram and repeating the keywords that you see on those, I think is real positive. I'm going to go, I've still got some images. I used to make £2,000 a month out of keyworded images in stock sites. But I've still got a few that are up there that are badly keyworded. I think I'm going to go and try and change a few of the keywords using this tool and see if I can get back to earning a few grand each month. That'd be nice. That'd be really nice. I don't want to tell you, I'm not holding my breath though. I don't see it happening. No. And last in the gear, we've got this. Oh my God, that looks amazing. It's the Premalus Lab D5500 Alpha. So basically it's a Nikon D5500 that Primalusa Labs have hatcheted and created a wonderful cooling section on the back of it. And you're thinking, well, why do you want a huge cooling section for the back of your camera to make it look horrible? This is, you can't buy the unit and then just take a D5500 and bolt the two together. This is a purpose-made unit, the whole thing. You have to buy the whole thing from Primalusa Lab. And it's basically to take amazing photos like this of the universe. So you'll stick this thing on your telescope. Your telescope will have a mount which will follow the sky as it goes through at night, and you will shove this unit up. The thing that makes it special is the fact that when you're doing long exposures, I mean, some of these cameras are on for 8 hours, certainly during the winter. And yeah, they get helped by the fact that it is pretty cold during the winter, but your sensor gets incredibly hot. And the idea of this thing is it provides a heat sink effectively and cooling mechanism for your sensor so that you don't get sensor dropout or any aberrations on the image. How much is it going to cost? $2,420. And it comes with a 4-year warranty as well, which based on the fact that they've probably invalidated the Nikon warranty is very good of them. I like that. Well done to them. And that was the gear. So your questions, if you've got a question, then you can send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll read it out. Just type a little photo show and then stick your question in the email and we'll answer them. We've got a couple of good ones this week and we've got a couple already lined up for next week. Thanks also, a huge, huge thanks, especially this week, to Ian Lewis, who did a very large part of the doc for me. I do appreciate it. I'm sorry, Ian, that I've been a bit lame and I couldn't do it last week, but I was out working. And school holidays are the worst for me because that's when I work my hardest, probably. Cheers, Ian. Much appreciated. I'll clear the dock at the end of the show and then we'll post it up and we can start the one for next week. First question then comes from Martin. I intend to spend 3 to 4 months travelling across the US, Australia, New Zealand and back via Singapore and Greece. That's a hell of a trip, mate. Well done. What would make up a good travel kit and cover both video and stills? Don't take a separate camera for a start. Get yourself a D6 or I know you're a Canon man, Martin, so get yourself a 6D or a 5D, something like that. And you can shoot video and stills with that. In terms of lenses, it depends what you want to do out. I mean, if you're going out for the day and you're just going around town or something like that and you want to shoot a few quick snaps while you're out and about and just some landmark stuff, if it's touristy type photography you're looking for, then your iPhone probably. Get yourself one of those Holoclips or some of the lens clips that you can get from Amazon and take those out with you. And then you've got some versatility on top of what you've already got, and you've got a great camera there already. And you can shoot some video. So, you know, day trip around town, iPhone, most definitely. If you're talking about going out and you're doing the Ansel Adams bit or that kind of stuff, look for a little light, small tripod, and definitely go for light. If this is something that you're going to keep for a long time, pay the extra money and get a carbon Fireborne. I had a moment. The lady that cleans the studio here, Jo, she was tidying stuff up, and she said, "What's this?" And she brought in this huge ball head that I used to have on a metal tripod, and I used to carry this thing around site, and it was weighed a ton, just the head weighed a ton on its own. And it's a beautiful head, don't get me wrong, but I invested in a carbon fiber video tripod a couple of years ago, and I went from this thing, which probably weighed, laden down, it was probably 6 kilos, 5-6 kilos, right up to a carbon fiber one that weighs virtually nothing that I can carry around. And I've got to say, it has been more durable than the one that I bought before. Look out there for a very small, but as sturdy as they get, small carbon fiber tripod. Get yourself to Calumet. I know you're down south a lot, Martin, so get yourself to London, go to Calumet and actually physically look at the tripod that you're going to buy. They've got the whole Manfrotto range there, carbon fiber and otherwise, but look for the smallest, spindliest, strongest, lightest carbon fiber tripod that you can get, and really, really invest in that, because I think to a certain degree that would be worth doing more than maybe worrying too much about the lens that you're going to carry around or the body you're going to carry around. I've got a very simple setup for on site. I carry a 16 to 35 mil lens. I carry a 24 to 70 mil lens, and I carry a 70 to 200 mil lens, and that is it. I don't carry anything else. All 2.8, so I can use them in low light. I can get good depth of field for a nice artistic finish to it. The 70 to 200 gives you the ability to sit back. You can take portraiture or street photography, that kind of stuff with that, and not get in people's faces. The 24 to 70 will be your stock lens. That'll cover you from architecture to general landscaping, right the way up to maybe zooming in just a little bit and getting a nice portrait. And the 16 to 35 is one for holy crap, look at that, and real big vistas and that kind of thing. And the beauty of those as well is that if you go into Photoshop, you've got lens profiles for all of them, so you can get rid of the barreling and you can get lovely, beautiful, flat images from them, which look stunning. That is, I mean, when I shot stills constantly, I carried the 50mm as well, an awful lot, and a 35mm. But now I'm shooting video and stills. That's kind of the three lenses that I've settled on, because I get an overlap with them and I got multiple choices of what to do with them. And it doesn't break your back carrying them around, because they're not hugely heavy. Well, there's a couple of kilos there. Hope I helped, mate. There you go. Question two is from Andy. He says, why were photos developed in a red light room? So the red light in a light room is called a safe light. And the reason it was safe was because you were processing black and white film, and black and white film was only sensitive in post-processing to blue. So red is the opposite of blue, effectively. I used to do graphic design and used to mask stuff off using red film, because in a red light, when you expose it over blue paper, the red goes black. Whereas anything that's drawn in blue, so you used to do your key marks and trim marks in blue pencil, because the blue would just wash out in the post-processing. So there you go. That's why you don't use a white light, because there's a lot of blue in white light and that would ruin your film. It only applies to black and white though, mate. You can't process colour under red light. There is no safe light for red for colour film. You have to do it in a completely sealed environment, completely dark, which is why when you get your colour film and you take it to Costco or something like that, they actually offer the thing up and it gets pulled straight in when it's completely sealed in darkness. There is no red light process, no safe light process for colours. Question three comes from Dougie. He's a bit of a mountain man. If I'm carrying my camera for a hike and need to snap a photo quickly, say for a bear, I don't know if I'd be standing snapping pictures, what would be the best setting to use? The pre-built modes or one of the manual settings, Dougie? There's no answer for that, mate. Because it's going to depend on the amount of light you got. So if you're, you know, at twilight or something like that, then I certainly wouldn't be trying to mess around too much with manual. Ironically, if you get an overcast day where you've got a good film of cloud over the place, then you tend to find you get consistent light levels in a lot of areas, even because there's no strong shadows. So, you know, I would set on manual for an overcast day, most definitely, and I do every day I work now when it's overcast, because you're not messing around so much. You can set one exposure, and that will last you for several different environments for several hours. If you get sunlight, strong sunlight, then that can be a real pain in the arse, and I never shoot in manual when I've got strong sunlight, because I am up and down the dial like a horse draws. It is a pain in the backside. I would always probably shoot in aperture priority, or if I was trying to capture something that was moving, like a crane head, or I wanted to make sure there was blur or wasn't blur, then I'd go into shutter priority and I'd tell it how fast I wanted it to shoot. I think I would say, and I think Ian agrees with me based on some of the comments that he's made here in the document, if you're chasing something through some woods, or you want to gather something in some woods that's likely to move, I would set the priority on the shutter based on whether you want it to be still or not still. So, you know, a sports mode or something like that, as Ian's put in the doc, is a good idea. I would also think about keeping your ISO high. When I had my 1DS Mark II, that topped out. You could shoot at 800 ISO in that, but it wasn't brilliant. I'd rather have kept it at 600 ISO or something, 640. And 1600 was just dog meat. It was awful. I don't really think that's the case anymore with nearly all of the digital cameras that are out there. You can push them up to 3200 quite comfortably. Probably wrongly, there's a bit of me that still tops out at 800 wherever I can possibly manage it. So set your ISO between 400 and 800, and then you're definitely going to grab something that's right there. Ian's put that in the doc as well, and I totally agree with him. There isn't an answer, mate. There isn't an answer. Think about what you're doing, really, is the long and the short of it. But as I say, strong sunlight, I never shoot in manual in strong sunlight because it's too changeable from light to dark. Overcast days, I adore. I absolutely adore. If you've got a question for us, send it to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll answer it. There we go. Nice and simple. It's shorter this week because I haven't got a chat room to interact with because it's 6 a.m. and they're not going to come and do this, so I haven't bothered broadcasting live. Send us your questions. Thanks to Ian for helping with the doc again this week. I do appreciate it. This is the only show on the British Tech Network that has show notes. So if you go to britishnetwork.com/photo and you go to the relevant show that we're talking about, then in there is a link to download a PDF which has got all of the links that we've talked about and all of the information and some of the answers to the questions that we've got in the doc as well as. Okay. Back to normal next week. Thursday morning, we'll do a live show at 11 o'clock, and it'll be smoother then up until work goes mental again. Thanks for listening. See you all soon.